So I have two young daughters. They're 7 and 8 years old, and my wife leaves for work before I do in the morning. So every morning I'm sort of in charge of getting them breakfast and get dressed and all that kind of stuff. And my kids, I don't know if your kids are young enough to have experienced this phenomenon, but have you had any experience with the YouTube Kids app before? Was that a thing when you were parenting your kids when they were younger? Okay. Do you know anything about YouTube Kids at all?
I just know that every time I upload a video to YouTube, they say, is this for kids? And I'm supposed to click if it is or if it isn't.
Yeah. So there's this app called YouTube Kids, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It's YouTube for kids.
Yep.
But what is so weird, and I want to know if you have any thoughts on this in sort of a cultural lens that you could shed some philosophical or theological wisdom onto it. Basically, YouTube Kids is just full of all of these YouTube channels of families doing things like going on vacation, having birthday parties, going out to the mall, checking out the newest bumper car place down the street, and these parents and these families will just basically do home movies of this stuff. And then they'll put this like cheesy music over it and do these really bad edits. And my kids and every other kid who's in that age bracket right now thinks it's the most incredible thing in the entire world. And I've tried to get them to watch movies. I've tried to get them to get into TV shows. They have no interest. All they want to do is watch these families live their lives and put these really mundane, stupid videos on YouTube Kids. And I'm wondering if you have any insight as to why my kids are obsessed with this.
So you know what I wonder about, and I have to continue to think about this, Derek, because you've just taken me into a world that I don't know much about. But I wonder if it's a little bit like, and I don't think we've talked about this in the podcast, like Byung-Chul Han's articulations of Jeff Koons' sculptures.
We talked about him. Yeah, we talked about Ted Lasso episode
because about positivity.
Of our positivity and then our culture's obsession with smoothness.
I'm also thinking about Han's take. Like Han, we talked about this in that podcast about how he thinks we're a society that becomes obsessed with the smooth. You know, like our cell phones have no edges to them, and classic Han, he's like, and we love Brazilian waxes, and you know, and we love the art of Jeff Koons, who's, I don't know if we mentioned him or not in that podcast, but he's got like these big sculptures that are all glass, and he sold one.
Is that the one that's the balloon animal?
Yes, it's a
like
it's
there's a balloon animal
a balloon dog. Yeah, it's a blue dog. I think it's at the Getty in LA, and it's just a big glass balloon animal, and I think it's worth like $58 million or something crazy like that. But Han absolutely hates it. He thinks it's grotesque. And one of the things he thinks is grotesque about it is, first of all, I mean, it's a sculpture of trash. You know what I mean? Like, there's something utterly stupid about a balloon animal. You know, like, in some sense, I mean, this is Han's point in some ways, is that a balloon animal has no kind of connection. This is his Heideggerian kind of, his impacts from writing his dissertation on Martin Heidegger, is that a balloon animal almost can't bear Dasein. It almost can't bear our being because it doesn't bear time. Like, no one passes on a balloon animal to their kid. You know what I mean? Like, you might pass on your teddy bear to your child, but you'd never pass on a balloon animal. I mean, if you've taken your kid somewhere and got them a balloon animal, you know, one of the tragedies of it and the beauties of it is that thing's in the garbage by, you know, 12 hours later. Like, it's
like a Happy Meal toy.
It's a total Happy Meal toy. It doesn't have even the longevity of a Happy Meal toy. At least a Happy Meal toy can get thrown in the bathtub and be used once in a while or whatever. Like a balloon animal, you're lucky to get it home, and it's just pretty much a pathetic mess if it's 12 hours later, you know? And, you know, there's something about, like, it's not a teddy bear. A teddy bear you might pass on to your kids, like, from your childhood. And there's a certain sense, like, the teddy bear is there to help you cope with your being, like, help a little kid fall asleep at night. And the teddy bear even can bear the kind of history of being your teddy bear passed on to your kid, and the fact that you're no longer a child and your child is growing up so fast, right? But a balloon animal doesn't bear any of that. It's just utterly pathetic. So
They're not going to make a Pixar movie about balloon animals anytime soon. Well, is what you're saying.
They might be coming. Who knows? You know, we'll be proven wrong here. But he just thinks that it's dumb. And then to make it into a sculpture, and what he finds incredibly pathetic about it, and I guess cancerous in many ways, culturally cancerous, is that when you go and see people see this thing, what they really see is themselves reflected back to them. So they take selfies with themselves now that because you just reflect out of it, there's no depth, and therefore there's no otherness, and that it doesn't give you a sense of being kind of, I mean, this is very Heidegger, right? That you don't have a sense of feeling thrown into the world, but you have a sense of yourself being reflected back to you, and it becomes very soothing. So I'm wondering actually if what this does for kids, this YouTube kids, is watching those kind of videos is a little bit like a Han piece. It is a very soothing reflection back to them about them. You know, like there's a certain kind of warm voyeurism of just watching other kids dance in front of a camera, that even watching a really good Pixar movie, since you mentioned Pixar, there's a certain way that narrative is going to give you a sense of your thrownness in the world. Like you're going to feel thrown, that you're in, that you have some kind of sense of you're frightened because here comes the bad guy, or you're connected with your own longings, or you just have to hold on and think about what's going on as the characters and as the protagonists move through the story. But if you just are going to watch 6 minutes after 6 minutes of kids dancing in suburban houses much like your own, with a little bit of music and just a little bit of gloss that keeps your eyes on it, I don't know. I wonder if it has something to do with it being utterly meditatively relaxing. Like, is there a certain way that it becomes a kind of form of mysticism, a kind of mysticism that's complete vapidness? Like, it allows you just to kind of stare into the abyss that's no abyss at all. That what meets you is a reflection of yourself that kind of holds you. So maybe there's something utterly insidious about this, that we have our kids like watching hours and hours of it. And part of the issue, back to Han, is it feels utterly effing safe. Like, it feels so safe. Like, it's better than your kids even watching a Disney show or something, because then there's going to be some kind of moral. There's going to be some in the plot. There's going to be some kind of moral problematic. This is utter safety, and yet it could be utterly cancerous, because the point of Han is, if we think Heidegger is right, is that there is something about what it means to be thrown into the world and being in touch with your own being as you're thrown within it, and there is some radiating kind of realities here of Heidegger being a kind of mystic himself, and thinking that what matters is being and grabbing hold of our being. And I just wonder if this actually becomes the opposite of that. It becomes a kind of Han sculpture where you get no depth. You just get a reflection back to yourself. And the reflection, like the Han sculpture, has a kind of gloss to it. It has a little shimmy to it that it just keeps you staring at it. But mindlessly, there's no plot. There's no otherness. And what he really gets at is there's no hermeneutic. You don't have to interpret anything. You know, that there's no sense watching this garbage. Sorry, now I'm being really... I'm making stands now, and I don't really even know enough about it. But there's no sense of having to ask yourself, what does it mean? What is it calling me to? What is it saying about what it means to be human? You just watch, and you just kind of mindfully turn off your mind. And maybe up against all the pressure and all the anxiety, even of children, it becomes a kind of brain unplug that could be a real issue. So just to give one more shout out to kind of Han here, because I think he's a genius, and I don't think we've talked about this part of him in this podcast yet, is he thinks that we would be better off, and this is something for church leaders to really think about, we'd be better off focusing more on smell than on sight. And I find that fascinating. And one of the elements he wants to get to is that sight and sound, which tend to be what dominates Western cultural realities, that those can always be accelerated. You can listen to your podcast. You're probably, some of you are listening to this podcast on, you know, double speed.
One and a half speed.
Here we go. You know, and even with images, obviously, you can make those go faster. But smell, you can intensify smell, but you can't speed up smell. And what smell does more than even image and sound is smell demands a hermeneutical, a kind of hermeneutical reckoning. When you smell something either good or horrible, you have to ask the question, what is that? What is that smell? Where does that come from? You know, so it is a pull into the hermeneutical, into interpretation. That smell demands this. Every family living room and every dorm room is a hermeneutical process when, you know, someone asks, like, who farted? Can we put that on this very highbrow podcast? But that is...
Yeah, we absolutely can.
Like, that is this kind of sense of, like, you're forced into, like, where does that smell come from? Who is responsible for this? That there is a sense of being, like, thrown into the world when you're hit by a smell that's usually disgusting, but, you know, even a smell that might be food cooking or something that smells delicious. But there's a kind of thrownness. And so maybe these YouTube kids is the utterly smellless, image-based reality of the loss of Dasein.
Well, especially in the context of my family's mourning when my two daughters are fighting over clothes and the dog is getting up on the counter and eating the cereal and I'm yelling at everybody trying to get him out the door. Like, I could see where this turning off of the brain and just going for the smooth would be really nice, you know? But, yeah.
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
When Church Stops Working, featuring Dr. Andy Root, is produced by me, Derek Tronsgaard, with special thanks to our sponsor, Baker Publishing. You can get Andy's brand new book called When Church Stops Working on Amazon or wherever else you get your books. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time for another round of When Church Stops Working.